It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if new revenue projections hold up, Wisconsin is going to have a budget surplus approaching $3 billion. We'll take a look at what Governor Evers and state Republicans want to do with the extra money. First, in 2018, former President Donald Trump signed a bipartisan criminal justice reform bill into law. It was known as the First Step Act. It was designed to reduce recidivism and long prison sentences. Fast forward to now, and thousands of people in federal prison are slated to be released early under that law. But a tool being used by the Justice Department to help figure out who gets released early may be leading to some biased results. We're taking a closer look at that story and talking about the role of technology in the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support reforms to reduce the length of prison sentences for some offenders and to lower the overall prison population? And then how do we decide who can be released early and who can't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Carrie Johnson is a national justice correspondent for NPR. Carrie, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Oh, happy to be there. Thank you.
Can you remind us of the basics on the First Step Act? What was it? What did it set out to do?
Yeah, lawmakers from both political parties came together to overwhelmingly pass this law. The first thing it did was to lessen the penalties, lessen the sentences for certain kinds of drug crimes, and give judges more discretion. And the second thing it did was basically create an algorithm to assess the risk of people already in prison and to give people who were low and minimum risk the chance to take programs inside prisons that would help them reenter society. And if they took those programs, they'd get credits and be able to get out early. And my reporting found that there were fundamental flaws with that last system, with that risk assessment tool, that it was plagued by human error and math errors and even racial disparities.
Can you talk about this algorithm being used by the Justice Department? It's called Pattern. What do we know about what goes into Pattern to assess this kind of risk?
Yeah, there's been three versions of Pattern. It's been plagued by problems all along. Analysts say it's gotten a little bit better, a little bit more accurate in terms of avoiding some of those kind of bungled human errors and math errors. But even so, in this new version of Pattern, 14,000 people inside federal prisons were still misassessed and will need to be reassessed. They were put into the wrong risk categories. Among the factors that go into this, inputs that go into this tool, are things like criminal history and other factors that people say could be racially biased, in part because, as we know, police sometimes have a greater presence and conduct more arrests in Black and brown communities than they do in white communities. And so some of the inputs in this system were already kind of suspect, according to analysts. And as a result, it's producing some racial disparities where it's over-predicting the risk that some Black, Hispanic, and Asian people in prison would return to crime or break new rules if they left prison. And that's a problem.
Carrie, if I'm in federal prison and this algorithm says, yeah, Rob is low risk, what does that mean for me? What kind of systems do I get into that can lead me ultimately out of prison?
Yeah, Rob, this means that you would be able to get credit for working a job inside prison, building furniture or doing some other kind of work, that you would get credit toward early release for taking a drug rehabilitation program, for taking life skills classes, for taking college-level classes online as a kind of correspondent student. All of those things would build up into your account and would allow you to get out of prison early. The problem is that these risk categories are a little bit all over the place, and there are also some racial disparities leading some Black and brown inmates to not be eligible in the first place, because only people who are low in minimal risk are allowed to participate in this programming and get credit to get out early.
Talking to Carrie Johnson, national justice correspondent for NPR, looking at a change in federal law. This happened a few years back. It gives a pathway for some federal prison inmates to get out of prison, but concerns, as we're hearing, that the algorithms, the systems used to say whether one person is too high a risk to participate in this, to get out, maybe flawed. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carrie, I think whenever we're using an algorithm, the hope is that This is going to somehow be an unbiased and impartial alternative to letting a person, a parole officer or a parole board or whatever it might be, make these decisions with their own individual biases. Are people giving up hope for that now?
They're not exactly giving up hope, but they're pointing out that these risk tools like Pattern, these algorithms, are dependent on the people who create them and what they decide is important and what counts. And so the goal of people like Melissa Hamilton, a professor, a law professor at the University of Surrey, who I consulted for my piece, is to reduce the disparities to an extent that it seems to be more fair to use this algorithm than to have people with all kinds of unconscious bias make these decisions.
Now, outside groups are pointing to this, and as you mentioned, some law professors and others. Is the Justice Department saying, yeah, even with this third version of Pattern, we still need to make changes?
Yes, they are. Attorney General Merrick Garland has directed a team at the Justice Department to try to reduce these disparities, fix some of these issues, make this tool more transparent for people who want to conduct independent research, all with an eye toward developing a new and better version of this tool. It's going to take a while. And remember, 14,000 people inside federal prison were put into the wrong category. So the Bureau of Prisons has to reassess all those people in prison once they come up with a new tool.
And when you say put into the wrong category, is it always somebody who should have been low risk was said high risk so they can't get out? Or does it go the opposite direction sometimes, too?
Yeah, that's what's so confounding about these problems. They go both ways. In some cases, the tool overpredicts the risk of a return to crime. In other cases, it underpredicts. And that is really confounding for researchers. They've got to wrap their arms around this, in part because people's liberty, people's freedom is tied to this tool. So it has important real-life consequences for thousands and thousands of folks.
Now, this was passed again back in 2018. Are we at a stage now, Carrie, where people are actually walking out the prison door now?
Actually, last month in January, people started to leave prison early because of these credits and the way the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons were allocating them. At this point, we think several thousand people have left over the last few weeks. The problem or the challenge is that some of those decisions may have been affected by the biases in this tool. So it's not at all clear to lawyers who defend some of these folks and advocates who watch all of these issues from a civil rights perspective, that this was really a fair process.
Now, this is a federal program involving federal prisons. As I understand it, Carrie, most inmates in prison in this country are in state prisons. Are people at the state level, as far as you know, looking at this as a possible model or else cautionary example for their own systems?
In fact, members of Congress at the federal level got some of these ideas from advancements in the states. Some of these ideas have already been put into place in states. And in the criminal justice system across many states, their use of risk assessment and other algorithms. The problem is this is the first time the federal government has tried to do this and tie it to people's liberty, the ability to leave prison early. And they didn't do such a good job. They're trying, but it still doesn't seem quite right.
What are you watching for next as the Justice Department continues to, I guess, tweak this system?
I think that there are some people out there, including the ACLU, the Sentencing Project, and the federal public defenders, who believe the Justice Department should just pause the use of this tool, that there's really no way to fix some of these fundamental flaws, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on senior Justice Department officials to pause or scrap this Pattern algorithm altogether in the months and years ahead.
If the algorithm is scrapped, does that kill the whole First Step Act then, effectively?
No, the reforms that were intended to lighten the prison sentences for people convicted of new crimes like drug-related crimes and nonviolent offenses like that would continue as part of the First Step Act. And importantly, the First Step Act allowed people in prison who are really in dire circumstances in terms of being sick to petition courts directly for compassionate release. That program has allowed at least 300 people in prison to leave during the pandemic, and that would continue too.
Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Carrie Johnson, National Justice Correspondent for NPR. She was with us today to talk about racial biases in a Justice Department tool meant to determine eligibility for early release for federal prisoners. Up next, we'll talk to a Wisconsin expert about how risk assessments work and hear about the upsides and downsides of risk assessment technology. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the use of risk prediction technology, these algorithms we've just been hearing about in the criminal justice system, determining who might be eligible to get out of prison earlier? Do algorithms and data have a place in determining who gets released early from prison or who has to stay in jail before a trial? If you've encountered these systems, the criminal justice system, as a defendant, inmate, parolee, or you work in the system, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about the role of risk assessment in the criminal justice system and why new technology used for risk assessment can lead to biased results. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences on one side or the other of these issues. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Caldwell joins us now. He's a senior lecturer in psychology and part of the Center for Law, Society, and Justice at UW-Madison. He's also a senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison, where he's provided risk assessments. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You do clinical risk assessments in your work. Can you tell us how that differs from these algorithm risk assessments we were just hearing about?
Well, a clinical risk assessment is based on the clinician's experience and their understanding of the current research. So it's not as mechanical as the algorithms that are used. The person has to be very up to date on the current research, and also their methodology has to be guided by what's known from the research.
What kind of things are part of the latest research when it comes to evaluating whether someone, if they're released from an institutional setting, a correctional setting, is going to put other people at risk?
Well, that's a complicated question because no two people are exactly alike. A lot of people who have alcohol or drug problems are higher risk, for example. But, of course, somebody who is into a good recovery program and is working that well may not be. And age plays a big role in people's tendency to do antisocial behavior and criminal behavior. And then there's just all kinds of things around what kind of a setting is the person going back to? Do they have family support that's going to help them or hurt them? Are they in a situation where they can get a job and housing and all those kinds of things? So it's a pretty complicated set of factors that come together.
How much concern is there that racial bias can creep into, first of all, these kinds of in-person clinical assessments?
There should be quite a bit of concern on the clinical end and also on when it comes to these algorithms as well. One of the things, of course, you look at is the person's behavior pattern over time. But as we know, different jurisdictions enforce laws in different ways, we want that. We have local prosecutors elected, and they have different, slightly different ways they handle certain cases. So you have to be somewhat familiar with all of that and kind of take that into consideration as you go. But we also know, of course, that all of the information you're relying on, whether it's research in a clinical assessment or whether it's a actuarial or algorithm type of risk assessment, it's all based on information from a number of years ago, maybe 10 or 20 years ago. That's when you originally code the information. That's the foundation for the assessment. And we know that there's been a number of biases built into the system, kind of woven into the system, without even being, at times without it being deliberate. So if you take a model and it's a pretty accurate description of how things worked, say, 20 years ago, and you apply it today, it's going to work the way it did 20 years ago. And if you want to do things better than we did 20 years ago, you're going to have to vary from that model in some ways. And it's not always 100% clear what's the best way to vary from that model.
Do you see it as possible that we can come up with some sort of algorithm system, whatever that might look like, that does help filter out some of the bias? Or are we doomed to, I don't know, garbage in, garbage out in that kind of system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it's possible to mitigate some of the bias built into these systems, but I think more often you're in a situation where you have to apply these structured risk assessments in something other than a mechanistic way. You have to recognize that there's some bias built into them, and things have changed over time. And also, one of the other characteristics of these algorithms is that it's much easier to code static variables in a person's history. It's much easier to collect information on how many times they've been arrested or what kinds of crimes they've been arrested for than it is to quantify personal change. How much has the person changed since they were last arrested? That's a tough one to nail down because people change in different ways. And so these scales tend to be very insensitive to personal change. They tend to give you about the same risk today that they would have given you if you had scored them, 10 years ago. They have to be, if they're going to be used and not do more harm than good, they have to be used in something other than a mechanistic way where the number, you get a certain number and that directly results in a certain outcome.
We're talking to Michael Caldwell, senior lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. We're talking about risk assessment to determine if people can leave a correctional facility, a jail or prison, how these things work. And this, as we're hearing, the flaws that can sometimes end up even in algorithms that we hope will be impartial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We heard from Anna in West Bend who couldn't stay on the line. Anna says her child's father was convicted for child molestation, sentenced to 30 years, was released 10 years early because of an algorithm and the pandemic. And Anna says it caused great trouble, concern for the families associated with him. Does that come up in these evaluations, the impact on past victims and maybe their concerns for the future for someone going through this kind of evaluation?
I don't know of any of the algorithms that specifically capture that. There's an indirect way that they may capture how serious the crime was that the person did, how much harm the victim experienced, in the sense that they may give more weight to, for example, violent crimes against the number of violent crimes against a person and less weight to fewer violent crimes, but nothing direct that I'm aware of in most of these algorithms. And again, a hard thing to capture how much harm the victim has experienced.
It seems like this goes way back in criminology and prison systems, the idea that we can come up with a scientific system that's going to help make our decisions for us when, as you say, every story is unique, every person in the system is unique. Is this a circle we're never going to be able to square?
Well, I think we've gotten a little ways down the road. We're doing better than we did, say, 50 years ago. I don't think these algorithms and the actuarial measures that we're using are completely useless, but I do think they have to be well understood by the people that are using them, and especially the limitations that they present. As I mentioned, the change and the strength that the person brings to the situation, and actually, as the caller said, the potential harm, all those things need to be considered along with whatever the mechanistic score shows you.
One thing I wanted to ask about is transparency of these systems. Some of these risk assessment technology tools and algorithms are coming from private companies who don't always let everyone know, I guess, what goes into the process. How important is it to you that there's transparency? We know what goes into these decisions.
Yeah, that's transparency of privately developed scales is a serious problem. And I think the people that develop the scales would agree with that. They would say that the way that they developed the scale is proprietary information, just the same way that Google or Amazon might say that the way that their algorithms work is also private proprietary information. But what that means is that you can't have an independent check on how well that works, and especially you can't have an independent check on how should it apply to this particular individual. Is this person all of these risk assessment scales worked on the assumption that the person that you're evaluating pretty much matches the group that you use to develop the scale. And of course, there are exceptions to that. People who don't actually match, who have an unusual mental disorder or some other kind of unique characteristic that wasn't well represented in the original sample. So it's very difficult to pull that out or to examine that in these so-called black box scores.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Michael Caldwell, senior lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison and a senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison. He's with us today to talk about how risk assessments are used in the criminal justice system and the kinds of bias and transparency concerns there are in risk assessment technology algorithms that are used at the state and federal levels. Now, if some new projections hold up, the state's going to have quite a bit of extra money on hand when the current budget cycle ends next year. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau had originally said we'd be looking at a roughly $0.9 billion surplus. Last week, it revised the estimate to $3.8 billion. So now, people are weighing in on what to do about it. Governor Evers said last week he wants to give every state resident some cash right now.
Under my plan, every Wisconsinite will be able to receive the full $150 for themselves and each of their dependents, meaning a family of four will receive $600 to help make ends meet. That means a little less stress and a little more wiggle room in a family budget and help those who really need it.
Evers also wants to commit $103 million for an income tax credit for caregivers, $139 million for higher education, and $610 million for public schools. Republicans say Evers' tax rebate amounts to an election year gimmick. They say they'd rather wait until the next budget and make some bigger changes to the state's overall tax code. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see done with the extra money? How do you feel about spending some of it on Wisconsin residents, caregivers, and education? Or is tax reform a better solution? Rainy day fund? Or is there some other need that should be addressed? Should it be spent now or later? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonah Ralston is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. He's coordinator of the university's public policy and administration program. His areas of interest include state politics. Jonah, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you today, Rob.
That's a big swing in our end of two-year budget projection. How did this happen? Where is this extra money coming from?
So part of the reason, of course, has to do with the federal injection of money. Many states right now are actually in a pretty good financial position as a result of that infusion of federal money. It also has to do with the health of the economy being a bit better than what was expected. And so that leads to higher tax revenues.
And of course, this isn't a $3.8 billion sitting in the bank right now. This is the latest projection on what's waiting for us in, what, a year and a half or so?
So these are projections, and it just so happens that, as you had mentioned at the top of the hour, half hour here, that the projections came in a bit higher, but, you know, to the tune of a few billion dollars than what was expected.
Let's look at first what Governor Evers is proposing to do with the money. We just heard him there talking about $150 per person in Wisconsin and then some spending on things like education and relief for caregivers. First of all, that sending checks to people, Governor Walker had done something similar in the last election here in Wisconsin. What are your thoughts on that as a policy idea?
Yeah, so it is. I feel like there are two potential narratives here to this. So the one narrative, of course, is that this is a cynical election ploy, and that's in fact what the Democrats said in 2018 when Walker provided the child tax credit, which you're referring to, you know, the $100 that was given. And the other narrative would be that, you know, this is something that other states are also experiencing in terms of a surplus. And in a number of those instances, this is also being seen as what a number of them are going to do, which is provide some tax relief, provide money back to their citizens. I don't think that Evers has been employing that second narrative as much. He's been relying more on the fact that, you know, external events like the pandemic and such are warranting this money going back. But I do think that there are two potential narratives here, and there's probably some validity to both.
Of course, Governor Evers, to make this happen, would have to get support from Republicans in the legislature. They say probably not. I want to give a listen to Republican State Senator Roger Roth, who's been working on a bill that would eliminate the state income tax, which fits into some Republican plans of what to do with this surplus. He told WLUK-TV in Green Bay, it's hard to compete with other states that have gotten rid of their income taxes.
Wisconsin has a demographic problem, people leaving the state. We've got to do things to incentivize individuals, millennials, families to come and live, grow, expand their families and their businesses in Wisconsin.
So Senator Roth and other Republicans talk about, hey, let's use this as a way to change our tax structure. First of all, what do you think of this idea of Wisconsin getting rid of the state income tax?
Well, we wouldn't be the first state to do it. There are, you know, a few states that have no income tax. But I do think that there is a cautionary tale here. Kansas, not too many years ago, chose to try to get rid of their income tax with Governor Brownback. And by all accounts, it pretty much was kind of a disaster. It did not go very well. And they had to end up rolling back a lot of the changes that had been made. And in fact, it got litigated all the way up to their state Supreme Court in terms of the actual decline was so substantial in education that it was brought up to the state Supreme Court as to whether or not they were meeting their requirements under the state constitution to provide education for their citizens. So I think it needs to be done in a proper way, and we probably would have to think about how to offset that tax revenue. So, you know, we're talking about $18 billion. This is a $3+ billion surplus. That's not going to, you know, meet the need there for the extra $15 billion. So you've got to figure out a way to still provide funding. What many states have done that don't have an income tax is usually they have higher sales taxes. So you can look at some place like Tennessee. Our sales tax is between 5 and 5.5%, depending on the locality. In Tennessee, that usually ranges between like 8.5 and almost 10%.
And I know there are concerns about sales tax potentially being more regressive, having more of a burden for people with lower income. That's one argument I've heard against it anyway. Is there anything to that?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in Tennessee, they tax food even at 5%. And so, yes, there are some concerns about taxing consumption and how that can be regressive. Right now, the income tax in Wisconsin, unlike our neighboring state, Illinois, right, where it's more of a flat tax, in Wisconsin, it is definitely a progressive tax. And, you know, the higher income that you're earning, the more you're going to be paying in income tax back to the state. So in that case, it's a progressive tax system. If you move to, you know, higher sales taxes, yes, it could take up a larger portion of somebody's budget who's lower income.
Talking to Jonah Ralston from UW-Whitewater, looking at a projected budget surplus here in Wisconsin, higher than previously expected, and what, if anything, to do with it. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. You know, 100 years ago, Martin Pattison donated land for Pattison State Park. We celebrated a centennial a couple of years ago. The pandemic hit. I've spoken with Governor Evers. I've spoken with Representative Milroy, Representative Steinicke. I've spoken with Senator Janet Buley, we had a storm in 2018 causing millions of dollars in damage to the park, and it still hasn't been repaired. And when I spoke with the park superintendent, he said he had a number of projects submitted to the DNR, and they pulled out the funding on it. And now that we have a budget surplus, there's no excuse for people in Madison to neglect this state park. We deserve better in our state. Tourism is an important resource we have. And I've invited everyone to come up here to Patterson State Park and see for themselves and talk with the superintendent has since resigned. So we're going to have to pick a new superintendent. But it's been 4 years for these repairs to be done, and we don't have the money? Well, now we do, and we need to get it done. And I mean all of us in Wisconsin need to start caring about this park.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Joe, to Jeff making the case for a particular park, but the idea of using it for park cleanup, rebuilding, and more.
Yeah, in California, they're experiencing a budget surplus as well, and they directed a pretty substantial portion of the surplus to environmental causes and concerns. And so, there is evidence from other states that they've looked in that direction. The cautionary tale here, of course, is that anything that Evers would propose or wants to do would have to be approved by the legislature. This is not the federal COVID-19 relief money, which Evers had discretion over. This is state money, and the legislator ultimately will have the final say.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go now to State Senator Bob Wirch calling in from Kenosha. Senator Wirch, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. In the last budget, the Republicans gave the homeless a real bad hit in the budget, meaning that Governor Evers put $13 million in to help the homeless. Not a big fund if you consider there are 72 counties in the state that all have homeless problems. By the time the Republican Joint Finance Committee got done with his budget, there was $1 million in to help the homeless. Now, by comparison, Minnesota spends $40 million to help the homeless. So I certainly like the $150 proposal by Governor Evers, but we should remember the homeless because the Republicans forgot about him in the last budget.
Senator Wirch, thanks for calling in. Joda, there we have it from a state legislator making the case to use some of the surplus for homeless relief.
Yeah, and I think a good point that was made is that, in fact, a number of Evers' proposals in this last budget had been stripped out and or reduced substantially. So if you look at what Evers had proposed in the last budget for education, for example, and what actually was funded, it was a fraction of what the governor had proposed. And so it certainly is the case that many of the governor's priorities, it has been difficult for him to get those passed or at least to get funded at the amounts that he has wanted. And so I think that's going to remain a significant challenge in this last year of his term.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the state's projected budget surplus and what should be done with the projected $2.9 billion. Jonah Ralston stays with us, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, coordinator there of the university's public policy and administration program. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen with that extra money? Put it away in the rainy day fund, send out a check to every state resident, tax credit for caregivers, overhaul the tax system in the state, or fill in the blank. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about new revenue projections for the state. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau says Wisconsin will have a $3.8 billion surplus at the end of this budget cycle that ends next summer. Much more than expected. Governor Evers wants to give every state resident a $150 check, some tax credits for caregivers, and money for schools. Republicans say it's a chance to enact major tax reform in the next budget. Jonah Ralston stays with us, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, coordinator of the university's public policy and administration program. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Bowler. Mark, hi.
Yes. The senator from Kenosha kind of took the steam out of my point of helping the homeless, because a lot of us really don't need the $150 to get by. So the homeless, I think, would be the best place to put it. And the parks, of course. That's all.
Mark, thanks for the call. And I've seen some debate, Jonah, from people who do support the idea of direct payments. The policy debate between send a check to everybody versus what Mark said, focus the money on people who need it the most, maybe homeless people, maybe lower income people. What are the merits of everybody gets something or some people get more?
Right. And particularly in a more recessionary period, you would see a stronger call for some kind of stimulus, right? So that would be a payment directly to people. We're not really in that kind of environment now, and the economy has rebounded to a good extent. So I think there is less of a case perhaps now than there may have been just a year or two ago for the need of a direct payment. It's not to say that it can't be beneficial or that people wouldn't use them, particularly, you know, during a period of inflation right now when things are rising in price. And so, you know, it could be useful for people. But yeah, those targeted kind of uses of the money, there is some merit to that. There could be some benefit to investing the state's money, if you will think of it that way, you know, like a good return on investment for putting it into high need areas of the state. Again, I just think it's going to be very difficult, and it's probably why, partly why anyway, the governor has chosen the route he has. He's picked some priority areas that he, you know, really wants to put some money in terms of how he'd want to spend the surplus. But I think he was trying to appeal to Republicans who, in the last budget, had a strong preference for giving money back to Wisconsinites through tax reform. And so maybe he was trying to put it in something that would appeal to them. Unfortunately, the relationship between the governor and legislature is so acrimonious. It's difficult to see them finding any common ground. It's almost like they're making policy in spite of each other rather than because of one another at this point.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go next to Mike in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'd like to see the money used in the university system to encourage our kids to stay in the state. I don't mind that people are leaving the state just for the sake of leaving. They might be retiring. But if they're leaving for jobs, we've got to have good quality jobs here in the state. I'd like to see some sort of a plan to maybe provide seed money for, say, 100 companies rather than one flat panel display company in down by Racine. Sorry, lost my train there, that turned out to be flat as far as employment. And then if I could wave my wand, I'd like to see interstate connection around the north side of Madison, north of Lake Mendota, to complete the loop around Madison.
Mike, thanks.
Alleviate the congestion.
Thanks for the call. Jonah, Mike has a long policy list there. The idea of investing, you know, the state has an agency that is supposed to help do some of the things that Mike talked about. What do you think of that idea of taking some of this money and using it for seed money, he said, for business creation?
Yeah, I think there were a number of good ideas put forward there. And there are a lot of positive externalities to this kind of spending. You know, that we can all benefit through, for example, investments in education. We can all benefit from investments in infrastructure. And of course, innovative use of the money are also welcome, like what was discussed in terms of seed money, you know, almost like the state being a capital venture fund here. But it's a great idea, right? A way to spur economic development, and particularly considering how hard hit many businesses were during the pandemic. This would be a nice boon potentially for entrepreneurs who were struggling to get things off the ground during the pandemic.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about a projected state budget surplus. Jonah Ralston is with us from UW-Whitewater. You can join in with your ideas of what to do with the money, if any, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I would say on a per capita basis, divvy the money up to the counties for road repair. because then everybody gets a chunk of it that doesn't go to one part of the state or the other. And I think if there's one thing that hopefully the governor and the Republicans and the legislature can agree on is roads are important statewide. So everybody wins, everybody gets a chunk of it. I say leave taxes alone, because you're just gonna have to pay, you know, down the road you're gonna have to raise them back up. So that's my two cents.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Jonah, I've heard concerns from people at the local government level that they feel like the state hasn't been sharing enough revenue with them for the kind of things Jimmy was talking about. What do you think of that idea of a one-time use of this money to build those local roads back up?
Certainly there has been a need for greater infrastructure funding in the state. So I think that the caller had some good ideas there in terms of using this to provide some of those needs that local governments have in terms of their current state of their roads. It's ever since the gas tax is no longer being indexed to inflation, which that happened under a previous Democratic governor with a Republican legislature. Kind of, again, the cautionary tale of tax reform here, right? It was a way seen as, you know, reducing tax burden on Wisconsinites. But at the same time, you know, a decade later, it created a pretty significant transportation funding shortfall, which has yet to be addressed fully. And so, yes, that could be one avenue to use this money, would be for infrastructure. And of course, it would piggyback on some of the federal investment in infrastructure that's going to be occurring.
Thanks for the call, Jimmy. Carter joins us now in Cambridge. Carter, hi.
Hi. Well, thanks for the call. I was enjoying listening to you gentlemen talk. I agree with what Evers wants to do with the money. And as far as what the senator said about Minnesota, there's a little comment I'd like to make about our sister state over there. It's 6 years ago, they proposed a fair tax law. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. The Republicans were fighting it, saying businesses were going to leave. And after they passed it, got it through, the following year and the year after, the politicians were fighting over what to do with the leftover budget from the previous years.
Carter, thanks a lot for the call. Jonah, something like that, a change in tax laws, and I think it was aimed at bringing more revenue, especially for wealthier people in Minnesota, seems like a tall order with the Republican lawmakers here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that basically any of the tax increases or changes that Evers had proposed in the last budgetary cycle were shot down pretty quickly by the Republican legislature. They certainly are interested in, as they are calling it, you know, once in a generation tax reform. My guess is, though, they're not interested in that reform with Governor Evers. So what they're hoping is that there will be a change in the governorship and that they'll have a Republican governor that they can work with to, you know, put into place that reform.
Thanks for that call. And Jonah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jonah Ralston, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, coordinator there of the university's Public Policy and Administration Program. We talked to him today about Wisconsin's $2.9 billion projected budget surplus and what Governor Evers and state Republicans say they want to do with the money. Thanks for all of your calls. A lot of ideas out there. You can keep them coming. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page to check out the latest reporting on these issues, or at WPR.org. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.